Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Wednesday, December 18th, 2024. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Maddie Oates, ship supervisor and bargaining delegate for Starbucks Workers United based in Cheyenne, Wyoming, and Michelle Eisen, organizing member of the Starbucks Workers United on both their big win on parental leave, which may help you get parental leave, and their authorization to strike. Then David Dayan, executive editor at the American Prospect, on the rudderless ship that is the Democratic Party. Meanwhile, the House supposedly strikes a deal on disaster aid and continuing resolution. The big victim on all this, the IRS. Benefit, of course, goes to wealthy tax dodgers. House panel reverses. It will release the Matt Gaetz report after all. Woo-hoo. So if you are interested in a potential job on One America Network, one may be opening up. Fed set to cut rates again. Democrats in Senate on track to match Republicans' federal judiciary appointment numbers. The Federal Trade Commission is on a tear. Lena Khan may be on the way out. They just banned junk fees on tickets, hotels, and more. And then made a $25 million settlement from Grubhub for its harmful practices against workers and customers. Luigi Mangione charged with terrorism in his alleged murder of the United Health CEO. Palestinians and their American families sue the State Department for failure to apply the Leahy Law. Judge rejects Trump's bid to toss 34 felonies because of his presidential immunity, because he committed those felonies when he wasn't president. American Amazon workers, at least some Teamsters, vote to authorize a holiday strike. The Supreme Court to hear that challenge to the TikTok ban January 10th. It's 9 days before the ban is supposed to go into effect, making, at the very least, my son somewhat encouraged. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is hump day. Emma is out today. And
last hump day of the year.
What's that? It's the last. Yeah, it's true. It's our last live hump day of the year. Matt.
Sorry.
We have
I'm going to be out of here.
Some amazing. We have some amazing best of compilations that we put together. But just a reminder, if you have suggestions for best of YouTube clips, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Majorityreporters@gmail.com. Put into the headline best of. Nothing else in the subject, I should say. Best of. And that way we will search for those and they may end up on the best of compilations at the end of the year. And if they do, you'll be able to listen to it. That's the prize. Also, just want to say there's a big controversy. We'll probably get to it in the fun half, but big controversy about supposedly Tim Pool has been bought out by the Daily Wire.
And big con, you're saying?
What's that?
Big con, you mean?
Well, you know, there's a lot of implications to it that I'm sure we'll spend time talking about in the coming days and weeks and whatnot. But I know that there was, you know, having conversations with some of the folks who worked for Tim Pool when I went down there to West Virginia, that, you know, there were cuts all over the place. And a lot of those people had picked up and moved. And if he moves his operation to Nashville, a lot of people are going to get screwed over.
But not the city that it's at, because I think it'd be, well, I mean, generally speaking, it's not good to have Tim Pool gentrifying that part of the country. But.
I mean, there was no gentrifying going on there. All he did is put a steel fence around his, like a house so that people couldn't get in. I don't know. But my point is, I know we have a lot of those folks who listen to the show. I know a lot. There wasn't even a lot that were working there. You know, I met maybe a half a dozen. But I was told that there are some of them, I'm just going to be vague, who do listen to the show, who are fans. And I just want to say, if there is something that you want to leak to us in confidentiality, you can send an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. MajorityReporters@gmail.com, and just write in the subject confidential. And we have different ways also of getting confidential material in other ways. But I just want to invite people to, and of course, that goes for any right winger. You can always send us that kind of information. We're always happy to have it. Okay, MP, I'm not even going to read that. Somebody's trying to pick a fight with us about saying that we make fun of people in knowing obscure Star Wars facts, but I bet each of you could type out a spreadsheet of sports statistics from memory. I couldn't. I have absolutely anything I can remember, people have heard me say on the show. That's about it. That's the entirety of my memory.
Stats would be tough. I could probably place them at their colleges or something like that. But
there's a couple of stories I want to make sure we get to today, because what's going to happen to the IRS is bad. There's a bunch of bad things that are going to happen, but I want you to pay attention to the IRS one. And we have some good news on the judges front, insofar as the amount of judges that the Democrats have been able to place, and a slight revision from the deal that, and if they did this on purpose, gosh, that's completely out of character. But Schumer had made a deal with McConnell. There were four, they were anticipating four circuit court judges. Circuit courts, Court of Appeals, that's like the next step below the Supreme Court. Obviously, very important branch of the judiciary. And then they had maybe, I don't know, I'm going to say a dozen and a half district court judges vacancies. And those are subsidiary to the circuit courts, not as important, but they are lifetime appointments. And they ultimately, you know, often will get into the circuit courts. And so Schumer said, well, I will trade you, because they're going to try and block the circuit court judges. We won't fill those. We'll just fill the district court judge ships. And McConnell said, okay. And then at least now, one of the circuit court judges who was set to retire, opening up that vacancy, which would have been Trump's to fill, said, you know, I've changed my mind. I'm not going to retire, just coincidentally. And now the Republicans are saying that this seems like it might be unethical. I don't even need to say anything else. All right, let's get into this. The supposed big story today is that the House has come to a deal on a continuing resolution. And this may ultimately, we'll see. I mean, I don't know how serious these people are, and we're certainly looking and finding out what's happened to Matt Gaetz. Matt Gaetz did a, you know, so-called force the vote move, and he's about to lose basically his ability to get hired anywhere except for his dad because of it. This is the type of vengeance they take out. On some level, you know, we saw this type of vengeance that Nancy Pelosi exercised on AOC just yesterday. Pelosi was still angry about AOC protesting in her office and from her, you know, convalescence bed in wherever it is, Monaco or Monaco, resting from a hip surgery, was whipping the vote against AOC in favor of a guy with esophageal cancer at age 74. Politicians are very vindictive. That's the way they get to where they are more often than not. Matt Gaetz is about to find that out the hard way. Nevertheless, the continuing resolution, the dynamic here is that if the Republicans could all agree on what they wanted, they'd be able to bring it up to a they would go through committee. And once it goes through committee, this is all just obscure parliamentary procedure. Once it goes through committee, it's passed on committee. Then it could go up for a 50-50 vote, essentially, or, you know, just a majority vote in the House. That's the way the House works. But if you cannot pass it through the committee, you need to go around in a different process, which then requires, is it a two-thirds, I think, or three-quarters of vote for passage? In other words, more than the Republican Party, you need a Democratic buy-in. And the Democrats agreed, or Jeffries put on the table, we will vote for this continuing resolution if we get another $100 billion worth of disaster aid, if you agree to use federal funds to rebuild the bridge in Baltimore that fell, and a couple of other things. One of the things they didn't do was fix the IRS funding. You'll recall Joe Biden and Chuck Schumer made a garbage deal about, I guess it was a year ago, where they allowed the Republicans to claw back $20 billion from over $40 billion that were specifically for auditing wealthy people in terms of taxes, essentially. And the $20 billion would have been spread out over a long period of time. Not, you know, a big deal, but not that big of a deal in the short run. That was in the budget last year. When you do a continuing resolution, all you're saying is, we're just going to do that again. And if you don't take out that provision that cuts $20 billion from the IRS, then it's in there again, and it's in there again. But nevertheless, there are Republicans who are pissed about this whole continuing resolution thing, because they want to cut whatever possible. And Mike Johnson's in between a rock and a hard place. Doesn't want to be responsible for a government shutdown. And here he is going to Fox and Friends with his tail between his legs. And of course, who does he respond to? Well, we know who the president-elect is. And you're, well, maybe you'll be surprised to find out who his name is.
We don't have a choice. We have to fund those. We have to fund FEMA. We have to fund our farmers.
Right. And yeah, exactly. Mr. Speaker, it's not just, so you've got a bunch of Republicans who are angry at you. They don't like this. And just in a couple of weeks, you're going to stand once again to run for Speaker of the House. And you don't need a bunch of Democrats mad at you. But, you know, and this is breaking news. You do not know. You know who also does not like this? Elon Musk, the world's richest man, just tweeted this bill should not pass. The only way you're going to be able to pass it now, Mr. Speaker, is with Democrats. If you could, what's your message to Elon Musk?
Well, I was communicating with Elon last night. Elon and Vivek and I are on a text chain together, and I was explaining to them the background of this. And Vivek and I talked last night about.
Oh, pause midnight. It for one second. And, do we know when that Elon tweeted that out?
Ducey was saying that was like breaking that while they were.
Oh, interesting. So Mike is saying that he talked to them last night. Now, listen, I know a lot of you may have like an issue. Like, why is
what elections did those guys win?
Yeah. they were voted richest men in America. Okay. But apparently Elon's pissed even the next day. I mean, this is all, I don't even know if it's palace intrigue, but it's fascinating just how who's in the palace?
The buzz wore off.
The Elon and Vivek are really adamant about not letting non-elected government bureaucrats make decisions about our government.
It was a tweet at 4:15 a.m. this
morning. Ooh, gosh.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And now maybe at 4:20 a.m., Mike Johnson was on his Twitter, his like a DM chain with them, but I find that hard to believe.
If you could, what's your message to Elon Musk?
Well, I was communicating with Elon last night. Elon and Vivek and I are on a text chain together, and I was explaining to them the background of this. And Vivek and I talked last night about almost midnight, and he said, look, I get it. He said, we understand you're in an impossible position. Everybody knows that. Remember, guys, we still have just a razor-thin margin of Republicans, so mm-hmm. any bill has to have Democrat votes. They understand the situation. They said, it's not directed to you, Mr. Speaker, but we don't like the spending. I said, guess what, fellas? I don't either. We got to get this done because here's the key. By doing this, we are clearing the decks and we are setting up for Trump to come in roaring back with the America First agenda. That's what we're going to run with gusto beginning January 3rd when we start the new Congress, when Republicans again bring control. And all of our fiscal conservative friends, I'm one of them, will be able to finally do the things that we've been wanting to do for the last couple of years. Right now, Democrats still control the Dems, and that's the problem. So
wait,
we got to get this thing.
Basic. Who's in the majority in the House right now? Is it Democrats? Oh, that's weird.
Right now, Democrats still control the fence, and that's the problem. So we got to get
done. Still
so
control
we...
fences? What did he say? Just go back a little bit, because I'm really curious at what he's trying to say. The Democrats control.
We'll be able to finally do the things that we've been wanting to do for the last couple of years. Right now, Democrats still control the fence, and that's the problem. So we got to get this
done. One more time, Bradley.
Democrats control Pence?
To finally do the things that we've been wanting to do for the last couple of years. Right now, Democrats still control the Pence, and that's the problem. So we got to get this thing done so we don't have the shutdown, so we get the short-term funding measure, and we get to March where we can put our fingerprints on the spending. That's when the big changes start, and we can't wait to get there.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Wait, could you go back over again? Democrats control Pence?
Yeah, sorry. I'm doing the closed captioning here, and I have a point of clarification.
Democrats control Pence. You know what it sounds like to me? Democrats should have also, if they control Pence, they should have gotten that funding back for the IRS. Democrats really.
Democrats control Pence. Oh, they got the pens. I think they have control of the pens.
Oh, the pens.
Democrats control the pens.
They don't control the pens.
Apparently, Pelosi.
They don't control the pens.
Got them cornered.
Democrats control my phone. I take it from my son. Folks, we got a couple of sponsors of today's program. End of the year, you're looking for opportunities to donate. Well, GiveWell is a nonprofit that researches and recommends giving opportunities, takes the impact of donations seriously. They make recommendations which withstand tough scrutiny. GiveWell had their own researchers spend months trying to identify flaws in their past work. And then they publish their findings, mistakes and all, for any donors to use for their giving. This kind of rigor that can help your donation make a big impact in the world. It really is amazing. They literally have a vertical on their page that is like every mistake that they've ever made in the existence of this organization. They have spent, GiveWell has spent over 17 years researching charitable organizations and only directs funding to a few of the highest impact opportunities they've found. Over 125,000 donors have used GiveWell to donate more than $2 billion. Rigorous evidence suggests these donations are going to save over 200,000 lives. GiveWell wants as many donors as possible to make informed decisions about high impact giving. And like I say, you can find all of their research and recommendations on their site. And here's the thing. It's free. And not only is it free, if you make a tax-deductible donation to one of their recommended funds or charities, GiveWell does not take a cut. Every dollar that you donate through GiveWell goes to the charities that they have recommended. The Globe called GiveWell the gold standard for giving. Here are some examples of what donations to GiveWell's recommended charities can achieve. One is bed nets to prevent malaria. It costs about $5 to provide one net. Nets can reduce the number of malaria infections. Enough nets and a large enough drop in infections can save a life in expectation. Never mind, like, sort of the knock-on effects of this. Also, and this is the one that I donate to, costs about $155 to vaccinate an infant. This charity provides cash incentives for routine childhood vaccinations. The funding provides cash transfers. It incentivizes caregivers to bring babies to clinics, for these routine childhood vaccinations, which, of course, prevent disease, reduce child mortality. And also, there's a lot of data that shows that, you know, with people living in poverty, and extreme poverty, they know best how to deploy their funds. So you're also, there's a knock-on value to this as well. If you've never used GiveWell to donate, you can have your donation matched up to $100 before the end of the year or as long as those matching funds last. Claim your match. Go to GiveWell.org. Pick podcast. Enter Majority Report Sam Cedar at checkout. Make sure they know you heard about GiveWell from the Majority Report, and that will get your donation matched. Again, that's GiveWell.org to donate or find out more. Put the link in the podcast and YouTube descriptions, as well as at majority.fm. Also sponsoring the program today, something that can both reduce your anxiety and take care of your family. It's called SelectQuote. Because there's a ton, obviously, that are out of our control. One way in which you can regain control, and also sort of that nagging anxiety that you should be doing this in terms of protecting your family's financial future, go buy some life insurance through SelectQuote. SelectQuote is one of the leading America's leading insurance brokers. They have almost 40 years of experience. They've helped over 2 million customers find over $700 billion in coverage since 1985. Other life insurance brokers offer impersonal one-size-fits-all policies that may cost you more and cover you less. SelectQuote's licensed insurance agents work for you to tailor a life insurance policy for your individual needs in as little as 15 minutes. I can tell you, it took me a little bit of time when Milo was born to buy a term life policy. When I did, it was a huge relief. It would be even greater relief. I don't need to use it, but in the event that I do, she and her mom do. And then when Saul was born, I bought another smaller policy just to cover, cause I had two kids at that point. And, I got smart. I was like, I might as well just do this cause I got to get it done. And if you've ever worried about getting coverage with a pre-existing health condition for life insurance, SelectQuote partners with carriers that provide policies for a variety of health conditions. High blood pressure, no problem. Diabetes, no problem. Even if you have heart disease, SelectQuote partners with carriers that can cover those conditions and others. And if you don't have any major health issues, they work with carriers that can get you same-day coverage with no medical exam required. Head to SelectQuote.com and a licensed insurance agent will call you right away with your right policy for your life and your budget. SelectQuote, they shop, you save. Get the right life insurance for you for less at SelectQuote.com/majority. Go to SelectQuote.com/majority today to get started. That's SelectQuote.com/majority. Link in the podcast and YouTube description. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Maddie Oates, shift supervisor, bargaining delegate for Starbucks Workers United. And then Michelle Eisen, organizing member of Starbucks Workers United, will be with her. We're going to be talking about this paid parental leave win and, to the extent that we can, what's going on with the potential of another Starbucks strike. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Emma Vigeland out today. Real pleasure to welcome back to the program Michelle Eisen. She's an organizing member of the Starbucks Workers United. I think we've spoken, I think we were just saying this is our third time, and we've spoken through the different stages of your unionization process. And Maddie Oates, shift supervisor and bargaining delegate for Starbucks Workers United, based in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Guys, welcome to the program. Let's, Maddie, let's start with you because this is, and then we can go to Michelle, who I know is also about to literally jump back into negotiations. But tell us about this big win for parental paid leave. This seems like a big deal.
Yeah, this is a huge deal. When I woke up yesterday morning and my phone was blowing up with news of this groundbreaking change for the entire company, I mean, it was amazing. But that started with us. A month ago, we brought this forward to the company, what their current policies are. Retail workers such as us that work in the stores, we only got paid 6 weeks paid maternity leave, 8 weeks for cesarean section, and up to 12 weeks unpaid time, where non-retail workers such as corporate, they already were receiving the 18 weeks of paid leave. So we brought this forward to them at the table and we were like, you know, we all deserve this. Like, what makes your child more important than mine? So waking up yesterday with the feeling that they heard us at the table, they made this change for all workers. And it's amazing. The best feeling ever, really.
I mean, that's a huge win. I mean, it's also, you know, I guess when you phrase it that way to them, they're like, it's sort of hard to justify why the executives who probably also have the ability to have the money to hire, you know, help in a way that workers may not in terms of their kids. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Michelle, before we start talking about like sort of the other aspects of what's going on right now, that's going to be a big deal. I mean, if Maddie's going to be able to get a paid parental leave for 18 weeks, and I believe it's like spouses and partners can get it for 12, if they're not the one to have the actually to have the child, this is going to be a big deal, not just for people working at Starbucks. I got to imagine if I'm, I don't know, across the street at, you know, whatever it is, Joe's Coffee, or I'm working at the supermarket or wherever, I'm going to be looking to this and saying, like, wait a second, if they can afford to do this, why can't we afford to do this?
Yeah, I mean, this should change the standard across the board, especially for service workers. I mean, the fact that it's not like, we, you know, this is not to demean anybody's profession or anybody's job, but when you do what we do daily, it's not like you're having a child and then you get 6 weeks paid leave and then you go back to your desk job where at the very least you get to like sit. You know, it is a very physically demanding job that we're asking these new parents to come in and do right after they've, you know, birthed a child or multiple children or, you know, had a cesarean section or anything like that. So absolutely, at the very least, we need that extra time. these are not jobs. These are not stores where it is easy to come back from having a child. I know that Maddie also has stories about, you know, her ability to pump milk in a place in the store once she returned to work. And the fact that the company, we couldn't, that space couldn't be provided for her. You know, I think we have to look at new parents as from the business standpoint of bringing new parents back into the workforce and how we can support them. That should be a priority. And it looks like, at least with this recent change, that Starbucks is starting to view that and understand. And this was a win for every Starbucks worker. Yes, it was. We are absolutely taking credit for this. Maddie sat across the table a month ago from the company and highlighted the fact that there was a huge disparity between what corporate members received in support after having a child and what us hourly workers received. And then lo and behold, the company's like, oh, we're going to give this to everybody. Great. We're glad that everybody got it. But, you know, credit should be due to the union for highlighting that and bringing it to the forefront of these conversations.
And we'll get back to this in a minute, but I imagine it's not a coincidence in terms of like the timing of both the strike authorization vote and the bargaining that's going on. But Maddie, give me a sense of like of you know, to the extent that you may have experienced coming back early after having a kid or coworkers, like just. For those who don't have a sense of what that's like, I mean, because it's not a situation where you're at a desk. Again, all due respect, I sit at a desk. You have the opportunity to, I'm going to take 5 minutes to, you know, I can change the pace of my work. If you're working at Starbucks, you have no control over the pace or being able to take a, you know, a random break when you need it in that moment. And, having been a parent twice over myself, like you get no sleep and you're exhausted. But tell me your experience.
Yeah, I can speak to this very well. So last year, as I organized my store to unionize, I was pregnant with my third daughter. And I had to deal with union busting left and right. We won our election. We demanded more hours. The company cut my hours. As a full-time worker for over 5 years at this point, I was working 36 to 40 hours plus a week and was cut down to 20, 22 hours. My ability never changed at work. Like, sure, I slowly got bigger, but I always came to work and performed above and beyond for my team. I was forced to work two-man plays, which is when there's only two people working the entire store. I was still performing full duties, lifting heavy ice, lifting mats to clean floors. You know, I gave birth a year ago today. Today's my daughter's first birthday, and I'm here.
Happy birthday to her.
Happy birthday, Fox. So I was working during the holiday season, though, which is one of our busiest times of year. I had to go on my maternity leave early due to health complications. I was injured when I had my daughter. They messed my epidural up twice. So the 6 weeks I was given by the company just wasn't enough. I thankfully saved all my vacation time for the year and took an extra 2 weeks off with my daughter. So I got two months with her with a back injury, coming back to work, full duties. I was also trying to, you know, pump for my daughter, and the only place in my building that had a locking door was my bathroom. So I was not going to be pumping milk for my daughter out of our bathroom, you know. I also wasn't given the space or the time to be able to take breaks that I needed to be able to do this for my daughter. So, you know, it's rough coming back to work, but if I would have had this experience of 18 weeks, I feel the whole experience would have been different. I could have focused on healing and actually being able to take the time to go to the doctor to get help, like establishing a full pumping routine for my daughter. Like, it would have brought such a better experience for myself. So it's empowering knowing that all workers have this opportunity now.
Michelle, I want you to give us a little bit of an update about what's happening in terms of negotiation to the extent that you can. But first, like the idea of Maddie talking about this stuff, and I don't know, maybe Maddie's planning on having a fourth kid, but this is a benefit that's going to people that she may not benefit from, but she's out there fighting for it just based upon her experience. I mean, that is sort of the seems to me to be the sort of the fundamental building block of the of what the union does just in general.
Yeah, I mean, that is the labor movement, right? It is fighting for rights for all of the working class, whether or not you may personally have an opportunity to benefit from it, because providing for all of us raises all of us up, right? And the yes, all Starbucks workers are receiving this benefit, and we wouldn't want it to be any other way. We would not have wanted this amazing benefit to just go to the union workers. However, the union workers are the only ones who are protected from having that benefit taken away, right? You know, if in 2 years the company reassesses and decides this is just too expensive for us to keep providing this level of leave for all of our workers, they can come and they can take that away, but they can't take that away from the union workers. That's the difference between having a union contract and having those rights preserved in that contract and not having a union contract. Do we hope that that is that's a decision that Starbucks makes? No, we don't. But we've seen it happen before. I've been with the company 14 years. I can tell you that there are benefits that the company offered when I started that they do not offer anymore because we didn't have a union. We didn't have them preserved in a contract, and they were able to come in and make those changes. We are trying to prevent that from happening in the future.
I think the first time we spoke, there may have been a dozen members of the union. How many members, how many Starbucks workers are now unionized a couple of years later? And then tell us about what those workers have authorized and where you're at to the extent that you can in these negotiations. I know that you literally have to go there in about 5 minutes.
Maddie and I are both bargaining delegates for our stores. I am store number one. So I think probably the first time we talked, it was maybe around that time. This was 3 years ago. We just hit the 3-year milestone on December 9th. I believe Maddie's store was number 385 or somewhere around there. And as of today, I think we're at 529. I don't know if you heard the news, but we just, our latest store to join the union, is located in Starbucks headquarters building in Seattle. We won that store yesterday.
That's fun.
We're over 10,000 members. So there are over 10,000 unionized Starbucks workers as of today. Just slightly over 3 years from when we won that first store. And just this year alone, we've organized over 150 new stores since January 1st of 2024.
And how many more stores are left? Like, how many more, like, if there's 10,000 that have now unionized, how many are extant?
Well, that's 10,000 workers. So
10,000 workers, right.
Sorry. 529 stores. There's a lot of stores in the U.S. alone. I think there's, just under 9,000. Wow. So the union represents about 5% of the retail workers in the U.S., which is not an inconsequential number, but it's a percentage. I think what we've seen and what is still unbelievably hopeful and shocking to me every single day is that more workers choose to join this fight. They recognize how important it is to be a member of a union, to be able to stand up with your workers. For years, we watched the company come in and change policy. There were never hourly workers at the tables or in the rooms where these decisions were being made. And for the first time, we have an opportunity to do just what Maddie did, to sit across the table from the people making the decisions and highlight our needs and watch them be addressed. And I think Starbucks workers are saying, yeah, we need that. We absolutely need that. We know how to run these stores better than anybody because we're the ones doing it. And so our voices absolutely matter when we're talking about practice and policy and everything that goes into doing our job and to making the company successful, right? The company needs to invest in its hourly workers because we invest so much in the company and we are the ones making it run, keeping it successful, keeping it, at the top. It is, you think coffee and you think Starbucks. There's no, it's very rare for someone to say, I'm going to go get a coffee and for you not to immediately think, oh, they're probably going to Starbucks. So it's important that the company recognizes our value.
Just give me the broad strokes of the parameters, what is being negotiated right now? I know there's been a strike authorization that was voted. I think it was announced today or the results of that election. That vote. What are the just broad stroke parameters to the extent that you can talk about it? Because like I say, I know both you guys are involved in these negotiations.
Yes, I will. I just got the signal that we're going to have to wrap. So I will go into all of that to the best of my ability. 98% of our members did vote to authorize a strike if necessary. We are still in bargaining with the company. We've been bargaining for months. Both parties are showing up. We're very proud of the progress on both sides in terms of the non-economic things that have been addressed. Without going into any details, we are ecstatic about a lot of the non-economic things that have been already settled to the best of, how that works in bargaining. but the company needs to show up with a comprehensive economic proposal package. And they need to settle the hundreds of unfair labor practice charges that are still standing. You know, when the company came to us in February and said, we're gonna turn over a new leaf. We want to work together on this foundational framework that's, you know, all these stores can then vote on in their contract. Part of the deal was that all of the outstanding litigation also be settled. And there's a lot of outstanding litigation in the form of unfair labor practices. But they've also invested this year. You know, we've seen them invest in the company. We have this new CEO. His compensation package is the equivalent of about $57,000 an hour, which is about 10,000 times more an hour than the average barista makes. And we would like to see that investment in the baristas. You know, like I said, we're the ones who make everything run. We're very proud to do that, but we need to acknowledge the value of our labor and our work within this company. So that's where we are right now. We need them to come with a comprehensive economic package that is acceptable and shows our value within the company. And we need this outstanding litigation to be settled so that we can all move forward together in a partnership, which is what both sides truly do want, I believe.
Lastly, if I'm working at a Starbucks right now and my shop is not unionized, how do I go about doing that?
We are very, very, very active on social media. Our Twitter, I think it's SB Workers United for our Instagram and our Twitter. If you still do Facebook, we've got a Facebook page as well. And then we've got our website, our Starbucks Workers United website, which has all of that information. You just have to reach out, and anyone would be more than happy to get that process started.
Great. Well, guys, thanks so much. Matty Oates, Michelle Eisen, congrats on the paid parental leave. That's a great great thing to have happen and you've done it for literally tens of thousands of people across the country. And it's going to have, like I say, it's going to have a knock-on effect, I am convinced, in other businesses. Appreciate the work. Appreciate you guys coming on. I know you got to get back to work and negotiating this. But we will put links to all those things you mentioned at majority.fm and in our podcast and YouTube descriptions. Thanks again.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And in a moment, we'll be talking to David Dayan, executive editor at the American Prospect. He just wrote a piece pointing out that the Democratic Party seems to have a rudderless ship, or be a rudderless ship at the moment. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder, Majority Report, Emma Vigeland off today. Joining me now, the executive editor of the American Prospect, David Dayan. David, let me just congratulate you on your latest contract hire. Joe Biden apparently wrote an article for you. Is that right?
He's some guy who says he's going to be out of a job soon and needed something to do. You know, he wanted to get some writing in, maybe see if he could, you know, polish up his chops on that front.
Doing a little resume padding while he still has the juice.
If you want the truth, we got a call from the White House. They were interested in placing this. You might have seen today, the president did an interview with More Perfect Union, and Fez. It's interesting that they get a clue on this, after the election, I think during the election, there was not much interest on the part of the current Democratic campaign that was running to have Joe Biden out there doing much of anything, frankly. But, Democrats certainly have a lot to learn with the communications side of things. And, maybe that's that.
I don't want to spend too much time on this, but this. I understand why they didn't want Joe Biden out there because, Biden was unpopular and, showing the most amount of vigor and communicating, but how much of Harris campaign was a function of sort of the Biden world. And if this is like what the Biden world, if they're coming not to, I don't know. I mean, there are other publications they could go to there that are more conservative in some respect. They could have, Joe Biden could have decided to, write on Matt Iglesias's Substack. And I can understand Matt Iglesias a little upset about it, that it didn't happen. But and instead of talking to Faz at More Perfect Union, Faz Shakir was of Bernie Sanders' campaign manager, and is and certainly when the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, they could have theoretically gone to Morning Joe or something. I mean, so and they have nothing. Joe Biden's not going to run for another office. I don't think that's a news flash. So there is some actual set of beliefs there. Were they of the mind that this was problematic for the American public? I don't understand how they're operating here.
I mean, I think what's going on right now is that Joe Biden is trying to think about his own legacy and put forward some sort of coherent agenda for what he accomplished and why he thinks it matters. And I think it's important to hear from leaders when they want to do something like that. So we were happy to run it.
Right.
I think there's an inward focus there that has to be understood. He's not necessarily doing this maybe in some respects he's doing it to lay down a marker so that what happens in the next administration, there's at least a clear, it's contrast. Clear what he did and a contrast. So, in that respect, I think there's some potential value to it, but, I think the lack of it's the same problem that Democrats have in elections where they, knock on doors for 2 weeks every 4 years and expect people to know, what the party stands for. They know maybe in those 2 weeks, but there's a whole other part of the calendar where they're not doing a lot of communicating with people. And here we have this version of it is, presidents do some sort of legacy essay summarizing their agenda. It's sort of the written version of a presidential library, right? It's just that their version of history.
I get that. I get the impetus, but I guess my point is he clearly wants to be seen as having done progressive things, economically and, at the very least. And it's okay, why did your vice president run halfway towards that's the part that I'm talking about.
I mean, what you're talking about is really, I'm on here to talk about this story about the rudderless ship of the Democratic Party that I wrote. And I think that this plays, very well into the incoherence of the Harris campaign to simultaneously say, I'm going to be very different from Joe Biden. And also, I can't think of one thing I would do differently from Joe Biden is in many ways encapsulates this problem that there isn't sort of a core set of principles or beliefs. It's all kind of a grab bag. And I appreciated the Biden essay, but it is a bit of a laundry list, right? It's trying to fashion some things together into that, you know, sort of backwards engineer this coherent purpose onto it. But look, I mean, Democrats want to do a whole lot more than what Biden ended up doing. This is what he got through. And now he's trying to place kind of a coherent framework on top of it.
All right, let's talk about this rudderless ship because, I'm thinking back to 2 weeks after Barack Obama won the election and Mitch McConnell gathers everybody in his office and says, we are going to, under no circumstance, are we going to give this guy a win? And that was it. I mean, there was like one or two days of like, well, this is, you know, great that he won, historic, blah, blah, blah. And then, like, you know, after everybody got back from their brief vacations, they're like, okay, we're done. We're not cooperating. And we will feel the impact of that strategy tactics for decades. I mean, the last part of it, of course, being that third that seat that they denied Barack Obama on the Supreme Court that, you know, is now the number six out of a 6-3 majority. But we have nothing even remotely analogous to that on the Democratic side. And you we'll get to that point about like we have people retire and then stick around to sort of continue to mess with stuff.
Right. Yeah. So. You know, it's what you're talking about is called being an opposition party, right? And Democrats certainly have never done that with the sort of brazenness of a Mitch McConnell. The quote I use just from that same period in 2009 in the piece is how he said, we wanted to make sure that nothing was bipartisan, because if it looks bipartisan, then people think that everything's been worked out already. And there's not this great debate happening in the country. So we worked very hard to keep our fingerprints off of all of Obama's policies. That's what McConnell said in 2009. Flash forward to 2024, and you have a bunch of Democrats on very discreet policies saying, hey, maybe I'll work on improving the food system. Hey, maybe I'll work on, reducing defense spending. Hey, maybe I'll work on this, that, or the other thing, all of which may be noble pursuits, but it certainly doesn't hew to this idea that there's a great debate going on. And I think that the real problem is there's no one with the stature of Mitch McConnell to say, here's how it's going to be. There's nobody within the party that has any kind of respect to enact a strategy and get people to go along with it. And so in the absence of that, you have just a bunch of Democrats freelancing, whether they are saying, okay, maybe I can make progress on my issue, or maybe they're saying, all right, I'm just trolling Donald Trump to you know, the point that when he actually fails, then I can say, see, I tried, I offered the olive branch and they didn't take it up because they believe in this, that, or the other thing. I think that you get this sense that there's no opposition party, but just a 200 people in Washington pursuing their own agendas, because there is no leadership in the party right now.
I was particularly sort of struck by your description of how the leadership, Pelosi, Hoyer, Clyburn stepped aside and then didn't step aside. I mean, this is like,
I've never seen it before. It was almost seen as a given. It was almost seen as a given that when you lost an election and you were House Speaker and the opposition party took over, that you would resign. Like, that was actually a tradition until Nancy Pelosi, that, you know, in 2006, the Republicans lose the House and Dennis Hastert resigns because he lost the House on his watch. Same with
fun fact, of course, he went on to be indicted and imprisoned for being a child molester. But I mean,
other than that, but the point is that I could go back through non-child molesters, former speakers throughout history, who resigned when their party lost an election. And Nancy Pelosi didn't do that. And not only didn't she do that, she decided not to resign, even though she wasn't the leader of the Democratic Party anymore. And they made up this title, Speaker Emeritus, for her. And she continues to work behind the scenes, moving pieces on a chessboard as if she's in power. And, you know, this really comes to a head with this, these challenges to the ranking members, ranking Democrats on various committees. It was very clear to me that Hakeem Jeffries was supportive of the effort to get younger in these committee chairmanship and we should committee just, ranking Democrat.
Just the context of this, of course, is that we had Dianne Feinstein, who over her last years as chair of the Judiciary Committee, you know, was hugging Lindsey Graham and, you know, and sat on potential sat on the accusations against Kavanaugh for like months and months and months, really completely mishandled that entire thing. In a way that was,
I think the larger context is Joe Biden.
Like, and like, and
we
then
literally, we
Joe
literally
Biden,
had to get rid
Ruth
of
Bader Ginsburg. I mean,
So, you know, we have this gerontocracy problem within the Democratic Party. I think Jeffries was really supportive of it. He was silent, but it was clear what was going on. Like, he had no problem encouraging or at least not discouraging younger members to challenge some of those committee chairs. The problem is that Pelosi got involved and put her thumb on all of it. And it's not just even and it didn't matter what side she put it on. Pelosi had a longstanding beef with Gerald Nadler. It goes all the way back to when Nadler beat Zoe Lofgren to take over the Judiciary Committee when John Conyers died. And she saw her opportunity amid this youth movement to stick the knife in Gerald Nadler. And so she did. And she promoted she gave the blessing to Jamie Raskin to take over that committee. And it was a bloodless coup. You know, Nadler steps down because he sees the writing on the wall. There was another committee, David Scott, who's barely mobile, the head of the House Agriculture Committee, wasn't able to, you know, engage in key actions around the farm bill and things like that. Pelosi picked Jim Costa and said, we want Jim Costa to be the chair over Angie Craig. Angie Craig ends up actually winning that fight. But once again, there's this personality set of conflicts that Pelosi is moving towards. And then finally, there's the AOC situation where ever since AOC got to Congress and held a protest in Pelosi's office, she's clearly had it in for her. And so in the midst of this alleged youth movement, she backs Gerald Connolly, who's 74 and going through esophageal cancer right now, and chooses him over the 35-year-old AOC for oversight committee chair, and actually seems to do the most work in organizing the caucus to back Connolly, even though she's like convalescing from a broken hip in Luxembourg that she fell down a marble staircase or something, and she does it, and Connolly gets the job. And it's like, it's so infantilizing to Hakeem Jeffries to have this, you know, behind the scenes machinations going on with this Cardinal Richelieu figure who can't give up power and has to be at the center of all of these you know, whatever pursuits that she has. It's really, you know, how can anyone in the Democratic caucus know who the actual leader of the House Democrats is under these circumstances?
That's the of the many problems. But let's just back up, at least in terms of, like, you know, Connolly, and my understanding is that he's a very vigorous 74-year-old with esophageal cancer. As far as people with esophageal cancer.
That's a direct quote.
I know.
That's a direct quote from Representative Don Beyer of Virginia, who said he's a youthful 74, notwithstanding the cancer. Like, I'm not making up that quote. That's
now,
what he said.
What is the nature of that committee? Like, I mean, what is it? What, like, it, particularly if you're in the and we should say the guy who said that quote himself was 74. So, you know, you have a way of assessing. Right. Like, because he's like, relative to me, I'm exhausted all the time. I don't even know what I'm still doing here. But he.
Right.
But what is, so, but tell us about that committee, because this committee is like, if you were to genetically create a minority leader of that committee, or, you know, it seems to me that everything that you would create would be AOC from the perspective of an opposition party.
Right. I mean, the Oversight Committee has a very wide jurisdiction. Not only can it look at government actions and the operations of the Trump administration, but it also can look at things happening in corporate America and elevate those issues. We've seen drug prices come up in the Oversight Committee. We've seen defense contractors come up in the Oversight Committee, and on down the line. Now, the minority, sort of the ranking opposition member, doesn't have the ability to completely set the agenda in that committee. But, you know, several things on that. One, they can elevate issues. They can include witnesses in hearings that the majority decides to hold. They can hold investigations from the minority and you know, try to get documents from people and put out investigations that on various topics. And most important, I think, from the AOC perspective, they can use new media to set the agenda within that committee. And when if and when the Democrats win back Congress, the ranking member would get elevated to the chair position and then would have even more ability to set the agenda. And so, you know, one of the problems, I think, with Democrats is that they don't see the tools of Congress as viable to speak, you know, communicate with the American people on what their job is. And oversight is one of those key ways in which you can really make noticeable what's happening in the country. One of those famous oversight hearings was Henry Waxman bringing in the CEOs of the tobacco companies, yep, who said nicotine is not addictive. And, you know, he was able to create a tableau in that way that led to a huge master settlement and hundreds of billions of dollars and massive improvements in public health. That came out of a hearing. And that could happen again if Democrats had someone who was smart and able to work the modern communication system to get attention.
Before we judge, my understanding is that Connolly has a whole operation where he sends out postcards and reports on what's going on. He's got a huge snail mail list of thousands of people where he sends out postcards. I mean, it's insane. It really is insane because.
But I mean, it's more insane because, look, I mean, I'm sure Jerry Connolly has been kind of a loyal foot soldier to Nancy Pelosi. And, you know, Jerry Connolly isn't terrible. He's generally been a pretty good voice in that committee. But the fact that this is all driving on one member's personality conflict, that this is really about who Nancy Pelosi thinks is worthy of certain positions and who she thinks isn't. And it cuts even both ways, whether that means somebody older or somebody younger. That's the problem, that this is what a self-appointed leader of the Democratic Party is spending their time on, rather than how to deal with Donald Trump and how to deal with the near-term challenges of vulnerable people that we're going to have coming up real soon.
And the point, I think it's also important to emphasize, I mean, you said this, but I think it's really important to emphasize this. It is kneecapping Jeffrey's ability to be a leader. I mean, he's not my favorite ideologically speaking, but I want the leadership to be effective. And this is kneecapping. Like, it's basically saying it's every person for themselves here. And you don't have to pay attention to leadership. And here's the other thing I would add. Pat Ryan, if I'm not mistaken, was the one who did the opening speech for AOC.
He's one of them, yeah.
Pat Ryan, I think more than any other purple district congressperson, had a bigger delta between himself and Harris. And there's some things he does that I appreciate. He's up in the 18th district in sort of the Hudson Valley area. If he is not nervous about going out there and associating himself with AOC, he understands. I don't think they're ideologically, they're not at loggerheads, but they're not, they're not in lockstep. He's not a member of the squad.
Right.
But if he understands the value of this, it's just, are there other, like, is there a sense, and I know I saw a piece that said, people are saying, well, AOC will be in the leadership, soon enough and blah, blah, blah. She needs more seasoning, whatever it is. But is there a sense that, like, is there a cohort of people in the House, in the Democratic caucus, who are saying, like, this is just effed up? Like, is there enough of them going, like, this is just not how you run an effective organization? You don't have somebody who has resigned, like, undercutting the, I mean, this is, nobody would run an organization like this.
I think there are people like that. Maybe it's Pat Ryan, maybe it's Chris DeLuzio in Pennsylvania, maybe it's, other people. I do think that we're going to see some factions emerge that are going to speak to that this crisis of leadership. But that's what happens in a leadership vacuum. And it breeds people freelancing, and it also breeds people trying to take advantage of it. And some of that might be good because somebody has to take the reins of the party. And some of that might be, the kind of things that we talked about with, like, this memo from this Democratic fundraiser and venture capitalist Seth Lundin, who wants to create a new DLC, which is the Democratic Leadership Council, which was the centrist lurch to the right that led to Bill Clinton. Leadership vacuums aren't completely anomalous in the Democratic Party, right? After 2004, John Kerry lost and kind of stepped aside, and there was nobody really around that could rally the troops. I think it's worse now for all the reasons that we've described. I mean, Kamala Harris is socked away somewhere in California deciding whether she's going to run for governor or not. Biden is leaving the public stage. The past presidents, Barack Obama is like a movie and book influencer who sometimes comes back to give a speech every 4 years.
What about Jimmy Carter?
Chuck Schumer.
What about Jimmy Carter?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you? Because exactly. Right now, like, why wouldn't you include Jimmy Carter based upon the leadership that we've had so far? Like,
I mean, seriously, but Schumer doesn't really inspire that. Even on the progressive side, Bernie Sanders said, this is my last campaign. Elizabeth Warren, it's probably her last campaign, what she ran this year. So there isn't anyone really out there that has that juice, that has that gravitas to say, we're going to sit people down and here's what we're going to do. And I think the other part of this is that you don't always need a leader if you have the principles, right? If you have just sort of a mass.
The Democratic Party never is, super aligned, it seems to me. That's sort of famously a big tent and multi-coalitional. I think
one of the big things we're missing in the Democratic Party is the decline, dissolution of the Democratic Study Group. Democratic Study Group was, for many years and decades in Congress, was sort of an in-house think tank that generated policy, generated ideas that could be not only turned into legislation, but actually run on as this is what the Democratic Party stands for. And in the absence of that, you have a bunch of silos that come in from the outside. They only look at their narrow issues.
And we don't have anything like that.
And they grab the attention of various individuals because there is no sort of official, you know, I mean, the platform doesn't mean anything anymore.
Right, you know? Right. But, you know, I'm struck by two things. One, you mentioned Pat Ryan. You mentioned DeLuzio when they're talking about, like, you know, maybe they are part of a cohort that may have a problem with, like, the lack of leadership. I should say, just maybe it's coincidental. Both vets, right? Like, they understand, at the very least, they understand sort of, like, hierarchies and dynamics and, you know, cohesiveness of mission. This other part about the lack of think tanks, like we even outside of the Democratic Party, there seems to be a tremendous lack of think tanks. Like, I don't know what happened to the Roosevelt Institute. I don't see stuff from them. Obviously, Think Progress wasn't always necessarily, or I should say Center for American Progress, yeah. You know, I wasn't necessarily ideologically aligned from it, but at least it was like a milestone or some form of creating some type of structure within the Democratic Party for ideas. Because, and I think we've had this conversation before, plan beats no plan, and there are no plans out there. There doesn't seem to be any place that is developing. I mean, frankly, during the Biden administration, most of that stuff was coming from the American Prospect. And no, but honestly, like, where, you know, there is no outfit that is turning out general policy, even to the point where you could say, like, hey, that's too neoliberal, or that's, you know, too corporate friendly. Like, you can't even find that. So there seems to be
that's
like
what the Democratic Study Group did. Right. And because it was a little more institutional, it had buy-in and the ability to disseminate that information, you know, across the party. The problem is that we bring people into government mainly on the basis of how much money they have to fund their campaigns. And they don't have sort of a set of beliefs. They don't have very big staffs because the staffs have been gutted. They might have expertise on one solitary issue, but on everything else, they just kind of outsource it to, you know, whoever's incoming information set keeps them in good standing. And, you know, I think that the lack of sort of internal policy making and policy generating engines within the party have really weakened that ability. But even more so than that, you know, it's the crisis right now has created a lot of freelancing strategies around, do we work with Trump? Do we try to troll Trump? Do we try to bait Trump? Do we resist Trump? And the fact that everyone's trying on a different pair of jeans means that the public is getting no impression that there's any opposition whatsoever.
Right.
Not an organized one anyway.
Well, David Dayen, always a arguable pleasure.
Always a horror to be with you.
Yes. Well, I don't know. Do you have any, like, anything optimistic? Do you think that there is any even nascent movement to sort of get some cohesiveness? And at the very least, I mean, you know, part of the problem with a situation like this is there is no way to change course because there is no course, right? Like, if there's a rudder and you're headed towards, you know, a sandbar, at the very least, at one point you can say, like, this is where the sandbar is. we need to turn around, go the other direction. But when you're rudderless, you have no way to course correct.
Right. I'll offer, I'll try to offer something a little bit optimistic. So, at the end of 2016, beginning of 2017, there was certainly more of an air of, more along the lines of the McConnell, we're going to resist and make this guy a one-term president. That was certainly kind of the focus there. But Chuck Schumer was talking about, well, maybe we can do an infrastructure bill. If he's serious about it, we can work together on that. So it took kind of a focusing action to kind of put that to the side. And the focusing action was the Muslim ban. I happened in 2017 to be getting off a plane at LAX at the time that was announced and protests were starting. So I actually was randomly by circumstance there at LAX at the international terminal when those protests spontaneously began. And it gave people a purpose, and it showed sort of from the bottom up almost to the leadership of the Democratic Party, the titular leadership, that, okay, this is what our people want, and this is what we need to do. There are going to be moments like that early in the Trump administration. They're probably going to be around mass deportation. There are already organizations that are getting ready to, be arrested, to, stand in between ICE and potential people being deported. There's going to be a lot of publicity around this. And there are going to be, and that's not the only focusing point. There are going to be other focusing points. When Trump really started to lose his energy and really fall off on approval ratings in 2017 was after the passage of his tax cuts, which were very unpopular, very tilted towards the wealthy. And this time around are probably going to be even worse because they're going to be accompanied with all these spending cuts, where Elon Musk, the world's richest man, decides what government can't do in order to pay for his tax cut.
Right.
And so that's going to be another focusing action, an ability for Democrats to have, one thing they can focus on and rally around. So there's going to be moments like that. It's not like Republicans are going to be able to capitalize on this chaos in the Democratic Party. They have a very thin majority in the House. They have a president who on day one will be a lame duck. There will be a lot of jockeying underneath him. They're already mad because of this year-end spending bill at Mike Johnson, who may not survive, really. Watch for that.
Yep.
They have a lot of internal disagreement. So it's not like Republicans are well equipped to or positioned to capitalize on this, but Democrats need to figure this out and figure out who is driving the boat and where they're driving it.
This year, this period of time when Trump has won, and I've been in this situation before when the Republican has won, but not do it in a position to do anything that people can respond to. And there's just a lot of recriminations is always the most frustrating and depressing of times. Although we'll see, it could get more depressing, but, I love the idea of on day one, Donald Trump is lame duck. I hope somebody, runs with that.
Sure.
David Dayen, always a pleasure. Thanks for all of your work in 2024. The prospect continues to be a daily read of mine, and I'm so happy with what you've done with that magazine, and look forward to reading it more in 2025.
Wow. Thank you, and I appreciate all your work in 2024, keeping this thing going. Great stuff. And, I do want to say one other quick thing. We had a real tragedy happen at the Prospect. Our writing fellow, Janie Akere, 2 weeks before her 26th birthday, passed away suddenly, shockingly, last week. And so we're kind of dealing with and processing that shock. But I want to thank everybody for the kind words they've said to me and others at the Prospect. after we announced this yesterday. And
there's a GoFundMe too. I saw for
there her is and there is a GoFundMe for burial expenses for her family, and the prospect's going to donate to that. But I've been overwhelmed by the generosity of people who have already given to that and helped her out, helped her family out. It's sad because, you know, what I love about my job is I get to watch and help young writers develop. And so the fact that I'm not going to be able to see that with Janie is really distressing. And, you know, we have the memory of her, it's just a really terrible situation. It's hard to even form words around it, but, you know, I just wanted to acknowledge that and to thank everybody. If you were out there and you got in touch with me or whatever, thank you very much.
All right. And we'll put a link to that GoFundMe. Really appreciate your time and sorry for your loss.
All right. Thanks a lot.
All right. Bye-bye. David Dayen, folks, head over to the American Prospect. They do not have a paywall. But I would encourage you to support them if you can. All right, we're going to head into the fun half. Retro the Robot, can I get a shofar for my dad who passed away last week? He taught me how to be happy while living in a hostile world. I'm sure you that quirky MFers genes had more to do with my autism than any vaccine. Miss you, Dad. All right. Sorry. And El Conniption wants to know why I keep saying Starbucks.
Starbucks workers.
Oh, Starbucks workers?
Starbucks workers, Starbucks workers,
yeah,
Starbucks workers.
I know, all right, folks. It's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. We are wrapping up, headed towards the end of the year. Got a couple more live shows before the end of the year. You know, we'll take the opportunity on Friday to thank all of our members. Well, I'll do it today too. But it is our members, really, at the end of the day, that keep this show humming along and independent. And to the extent where they're successful, you keep us successful. Very often humble. Also, want to say thank you to Ronald Reagan for not only sending us a beautiful cherry assortment of cherry goodies, I guess. I don't know how to express
harassing that. Us with sweets.
I will also say that he also sent a gift. It's a game called You Can't Say which I took as a way of trying to train me after 20 years of doing this to not say as much. So I'm looking forward to that. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, hot chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. Bradley, ESVN.
On ESPN on Monday, we rounded up the week of week 15 NFL action and also discussed a little bit of our reactions to the Heisman Trophy ceremony and Travis Hunter winning, as well as some of Emma's thoughts on who the Giants may get in the upcoming NFL draft. YouTube.com/ESPN show if you'd like to catch up on some of our prior streams and clips. And we'll be back tomorrow to give you our top three picks of the week before we go on our little break. So YouTube.com/ESPN show, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Matt!
Left Reckoning last night. We had Matthew Sipman on of Know Your Enemy and Dissent Magazine talking about Clinton's, Trump's victory. And then we also talked about the AOC Connolly thing a little bit. And in the post game, we talked about AI. So check that out, patreon.com/Left Reckoning to support us.
See you in the fun half.
Right. Are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. 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 Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. 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 Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. 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 Back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back. Back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back. 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 Back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back. 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 Back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back. Back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar! What a fucking nightmare! Nightmare.
Bring back DJ Dinner.
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang.
Lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them! Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday! My birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black. Black Africans are back, back.
Come on. What? Come on. What? Come on. Really? Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy, 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 pussy.
We are back. Sam Cedar, fun half, Emma Vigeland. Emma Vigeland off today. Hold on for a second. My daughter's has one of her brake lights out.
Uh-oh, it's probable cause.
That's why I told her.
Better not be riding dirty.
Yeah, make sure you got nothing in your car that if you get stopped, you could get in trouble for. Hi, I'm a public defender in New York. If you're interested in background critique of the DA's terrorism charge against Luigi, I'll be trying to call in from a 908 area code. We will open up the phone lines in just a moment, and I would love to hear from that. It is messed up, I think, as far as I can tell. Well, I'll wait for that call before I go into it. But let's just start with this. Because I think longtime listeners know that if you want to get my attention, you either say something bad about Social Security or you talk about messing with the post office. Well, Donald Trump, I'm always sort of like in a like a spectacular bad hair day. I don't think I've ever seen him quite like this.
This is rough.
From 2 days ago, his press conference.
He's going to look so bad.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. But here he is talking about messing with one of the, honestly, the fundamental building blocks of this country. You know, aside from the imperialism, aside from the genocide and the slavery and this and that, I'm saying from a positive standpoint, public schools and a public post office, when you're talking about the first 100 years of this country, this is it. And this is also sort of like a honeypot for the dumbest people in the country. Go.
What's your thoughts on the Postal Service? You mentioned Bezos a second ago, and I've always thought Bezos would be a key person to go in there and really streamline the logistics of the post office. But they lose billions.
Well, there is talk about the Postal Service.
All right, pause it for a second. Do we know who asked that question? Because it wasn't a real journalist. I can tell you right now, that's not a real journalist. Because first off, a real journalist who's going to ask that question knows that they don't lose billions. They don't. There was a big operating deficit because of a pre-funding requirement that Congress had imposed upon it during the Bush years, where they needed to pre-fund the health care coverage for people who weren't even born yet, never mind not working at the post office yet. The second part of that, Bezos really knows how to streamline things. How do you think Bezos gets the stuff to his trucks? It's U.S. Postal Service planes. The U.S. Postal Service is contracted out. And in fact, I would argue that they should be upping their rates for Amazon.
Yeah.
But they're afraid to do so because of what Congress will do to them if they do that. If they charge market rates for what the services they provide, Bezos, we'd all complain because our whatever it is, our staplers, or toilet paper, whatever it is, costs too much. So whoever asked that question, I don't even need to know who it was. I comes from a right-wing organization. It's BS.
And I've always thought Bezos would be a key person to go in there and really streamline the logistics of the post office. But they lose billions.
Well, there is talk about the Postal Service being taken private. You do know that. Not the worst idea I've ever heard. It really isn't. You know, it's a lot different today with between Amazon and UPS and FedEx and all the things that you didn't have. But there is talk about that. It's an idea that a lot of people have liked for a long time. We're looking at it. I think we're looking at that along with a lot of any questions for Howard, by the way?
Now, I will say that, like, you know, Louis DeJoy has done an incredible job of still like sort of like hampering the post office. From my perspective, you bring in a guy who does private logistics. He is there to essentially build in the fail for these organizations. So the idea of privatizing it becomes a good one. I mean, they do the same thing with Social Security when they're in charge of stuff. They cut back on the ability of Social Security to do its job in an efficient way. And then they turn around, they go, Social Security is inefficient. And they're going to do the same thing with the IRS. But just give you a sense of like just how, moronic the conversation is around this. Put this up. This is now, is this guy, who is this,
this
guy?
This is like he's a former rock star who is now like, I think Washington Pool's mugs, down.
He's like a panelist on Timcast. His name is Phil Labonte. He used to be in a band called All That Remains.
What is his picture? Did I see him when I was down there? I don't think I did.
He definitely knows who you are, but I'm not sure. There's potential you saw him. I'm just not sure.
I don't. He was there.
But he's a panelist. Like he kind of is in on the longer live shows.
Okay. I don't think I saw him. Most of the guys I saw there were, you know, seemed actually somewhat intelligent, but they didn't, I don't think they were on air people.
Right. So not this.
How do UPS, FedEx, DHL, et cetera, manage to deliver to rural areas then? Because he's responding to somebody, I don't know who it is, Dreamleaf, says Trump privatizes USPS. It's not profitable to deliver your rural areas. His own voters will be most affected. This is actually true. And then with the question is, how do UPS, FedEx, DHL, et cetera, manage to deliver to rural areas then? This is one of the dumbest things I've ever heard.
Instead of a post, that should have been a Google search.
Okay. If you try to mail a letter to a rural area via FedEx or UPS, just a letter, right? It will cost you, I think, a minimum, and this is probably understating the case. I get forever stamps, so I don't know how much they're going for right now, but what is it, like 59 cents a stamp? Can you just double check on that? Let's just call it 60 cents for the sake of like my inability to do math. Yeah, a minimum, it's going to cost you $20 to send that letter via UPS or FedEx or DHL. So the answer to the question that Phil LaBeouf or Labonte, is he from Belgium? Is he financing that whole thing? Put it back up. I just want like be able to look at it. How do UPS, FedEx, DHL, et cetera, manage to deliver to rural areas then? They charge $20, $30, $40 times more than the U.S. Postal Service. And incidentally, more often than not, those services are using the infrastructure of the U.S. Postal Service to deliver it there. And if it's privatized, not only will that organization say, like, okay, like, not only will they say, like, okay, we're only going to go there if we get X number of dollars, but all of these services that would provide delivery of that letter are going to have to raise their prices because they're going to be charged more by this other business that is going to have a board of directors and is going to have shareholders, et cetera, et cetera. It is impossible to do. In fact, it is the perfect example of not only why the government should take over a lot of industries that are basically, you know, sort of without profit. For instance, we have the government give grant after grant after grant to provide internet for rural areas. Those grants have worked sometimes, but even with free money, these cable companies or fiber companies think it's not worth it to us. Because even with the free money to lay down the line, if it breaks and we're only servicing four people, you know, 25 miles out from the nearest hub that we have, it's just not worth it to us. That is a perfect example of why, like, we should have one fiber system across the country and we should own it as taxpayers. Big upfront cost. We'll make it back.
And he mentions DHL and UPS. Like, those companies are profitable because they do the easy part of the moving things. The last mile is a USPS. So, like, basically, if those companies didn't exist, the USPS would be more profitable because they would be able to handle a lot of that stuff, too. But extremely pleasant mail delivery guy on Twitter, you can find him at dumb mail guy, said, for all the privatized the post office folks out there, just know this. See these little boxes on USPS shipping labels? Oftentimes, they're on Amazon packages, too. If the ones coming to your home start with an R, you're the first to get squeezed
out. Is that rural?
Rural. You're the first to get squeezed out of service in a private model. So, yeah.
The idea that, like, this Phil LaBeouf guy, I mean, I understand. I mean, why would Tim hire anybody who does any more research than he does? Because then you'd start having arguments with people on the show.
He wanted a guy to tune his guitars.
Hey, man, don't forget, I'm paying you. That means you got to watch me skateboard for half an hour a day.
Is that where you wanted to be when you were on tour like 20 years ago, Phil?
Oh, geez.
It's Harper's Ferry.
How does this happen?
The post office is not a business, you morons. It's not a business. It's a category error you're making. Like, it loses money because it's not a business.
It is a service that the government provides to you. Fantastic. Just shockingly impressive. Meanwhile, RFK Jr. was on Capitol Hill yesterday, going around trying to sell senators the fact that he, or I should say, the argument that he will not get rid of the polio vaccine. Now, of course, understand it needs to be mandated. And I suspect he's not promising to maintain the mandate. But how do you go from senator to senator on the Republican Party and assure them that you are worthy of dealing with health care for people in this country? Well, you tell them that you are going to make it harder for people to get abortions. Here is Tommy Tuberville on that very issue.
I remember his past and how he grew up, and it was fun to talk to him about his family. But at the end of the day, we talked about abortion. And the big thing about abortion is he's telling everybody, he said, listen, whatever President Trump, I'm going to back him 100%. And, of course, President Trump is for the three exceptions. We've all heard that. We talked about our farmers in Alabama, which they're very concerned about food and food safety, but not go overboard where we can't have good crops. And I can understand that, and he's very on board. He understands our farmers are in trouble, and we want to make sure that we have farmers that can make a living and we don't lose our family farms.
What specific questions did you ask him about abortion? What concerns did you
well,
have?
I just asked him. I said, you know, in the past you've been pro-abortion. And he said, well, it's basically he and President Trump had sat down and talked about it, and both of them came to an agreement. Hey, Roe Wade is gone back to the states, let the people vote on it, and that's been mine all along. I'm pro-life, but I am glad that the American citizens have a chance to vote in their state, and he's the same way.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's tough with Tuberville. Hard to get like a full comprehension of what he's saying there. I think what he's saying is that he told me everything I wanted to hear and doesn't have any consistent positions. Because I think what Tuberville was saying is like, no, I heard this stuff about the food safety, but he's lying. He's not going to get this stuff out, and we're going to be able to spray all our stuff in Alabama for our farmers. And also, has no real he's just going to be a team player in terms of abortion and keep people from getting abortions. But here is Josh Hawley letting the cat out of the bag a little bit more. Now, maybe, to be fair, Josh Hawley may have asked more specific questions, because as much of an a-hole as Hawley is, he's not as stupid as Tommy Tuberville. I mean, Tommy Tuberville is just sort of like another level.
Yeah, I mean, you don't even want to compete at that level.
Hawley says, today I got to sit down with Robert Kennedy Jr. We had a substantive discussion about American healthcare and his plans to take on Big Pharma, which, of course, is code for no mandates on vaccines that are important to maintain some type of immunity.
And big polio.
Uh-huh. I think they're probably not going to touch the testosterone replacement therapy industry. That, I think, is protected.
They got representation on that.
They got representation in there. They have a seat at the table, as it were.
Or all the seats.
Nothing against your TRT, but in other words, don't worry. You're not going to be weeping soon.
Yeah, it's against God, said the guy's glowing orange from testosterone.
Oh, that's not the one I'm talking about. Oh, no, I'm talking about Kennedy.
Oh, right.
Holly goes on to say, he committed to me to reinstate Trump's pro-life policies at Health and Human Services.
So this is what we're focused
on? Wait, what? I thought it was we leave it up to the states.
Oh, yeah. Is that a State Department, HHS?
That includes reinstating the Mexico City policy and ending taxpayer funding for abortions domestically. So in other words, you know, any type of like, we're basically saying it's no longer a health service. He supports reinstating the bar on Title X funds going to organizations that promote abortion. By promote abortion, it says like it exists. He pledged to reverse the Biden administration's 1557 rule and also said all of his deputies would be pro-life at HHS. In other words, anti-abortion. He told me he believes there are far too many abortions in the U.S. Just Google, while we keep this up, the rate of abortions in this country. Back when Bobby was supposedly pro-life, I mean, excuse me, pro-choice. We'll see what the abortions were and see where they are now. He told me he believes there are far too many abortions in the U.S. and we cannot be the moral leader of the free world with abortion rates so high. Speaking of moral leaders, moral leadership when it comes to abortion, I think that when you talk about morality and you talk about being a moral leader, an abortion seems to me it's an appropriate question to ask Kennedy. Have you ever been involved with anyone who had to get an abortion that you played a part in, whether you had impregnated that person or helped get them or pay for them for an abortion? I think it's a worthwhile question. Because if you're going to talk about morality, and this is the important thing, maybe we need to assess the morality. I mean, this seems like a question for everybody. For Trump, too, right? I mean, if this is a moral question. RFK pledged to reinstate conscience protections for healthcare providers. What that means is that the state which licensed healthcare providers does not have to require that these healthcare providers actually provide healthcare if their religion says they don't want to. So maybe you don't have to treat a gay person who has a disease because your religion doesn't like gay people.
We're a Catholic insurer. I just can't get over that. It takes zero time at all to move from, okay, RFK, the health nut, and we're going to get all this bad stuff out of food to, yeah, we exclusively talked about taking away the right to choice.
Yeah, I mean, they're dancing around this. And this should be a question that is, you know, asked of Kennedy in his confirmation hearings. I mean, if you want to talk about morality of abortion, how moral have you been? If you're setting this as a requirement for yourself, I mean, you're setting the requirement for us to be a moral country, whatever that means. It's a function of how many abortions exist in this country at any given time. Then it seems to me it's a perfectly legitimate question to say, well, okay, how moral are you to take on this role of being the moral policeman of the country? That seems like a perfectly reasonable question. And apparently, if your morality can be assessed by how many abortions you've been involved with as a country, I don't understand why that wouldn't apply to people. Now, maybe Kennedy has never, ever been involved with abortions. I don't know. I guess we'd have to ask him to find out. Here is the change in abortions over time. You will note that in 1973, the abortion rate almost annually was 1.5 million. That's after it was made legal, you know, and people started actually feeling comfortable reporting it.
Yeah, exactly, because no society's actually gotten rid of abortion. It just goes underground.
Right. This is just legal abortions. You will note it has gone down significantly since then. Different organizations have a slightly different assessment of what's happening, but more or less, you can see the trend lines. So he thinks there's far too many abortions now. What year is he talking about relative to when? Legal abortions.
I think the right number of abortions is however many people need an abortion.
This will be a good question for him about this morality thing. I'm curious about it. Meanwhile, the right wing, in an attempt to sell at least part of RFK Jr.'s agenda, and they're stumbling all over themselves to promote healthy eating. Here is Sean Hannity. And you'll recall yesterday, we covered Ainsley Earhart, or whatever her name is, saying that how come it is in Europe and Italy, you can eat pasta all day and gain no weight, but then you come back here and you have one portion of pasta and you gain weight, which is just, it's just amazing to me that there's no sort of like bar you have to surpass and just sort of basic intelligence to be able to get on an outlet with millions of people listening to what you say. But the fact is that pasta in Europe does not make you thinner than pasta does here. It's how much you eat. But it's just weird. It's almost like it's a talking point there, because guess who else said the exact same thing later that day?
No, why won't Europe take our food? Is it hormones, pesticides? Why won't they import our food? And, you know, I've taken a couple of trips to Italy. Why is the food cleaner there? Why do you not gain weight and you can eat the pasta there and pizza there?
Yeah, it's all of the above. It has everything to do with the seeds that we're planting. They're genetically engineered. The chemicals that are sprayed on these seeds that are banned in Europe and other countries of the developed world. And the chemicals...
Pause it. I should say, pesticides are not always great. Sometimes you need them. If you can get organic... sort of like pesticides to protect things, like, you know, like sometimes you can spray stuff with stuff that isn't chemicals, and that's, I think, healthier and better. But it's not going to make you lose weight. The pesticides do not make you gain weight. And to be clear, on one hand, you have Tommy Tuberville, the senators, and the entire Republican Party dedicated to supporting Big Ag. On the other hand, you have this joke. They don't care about food safety. They don't care about cleanliness of food. They don't want government. Here's Sean Hannity. And I'm sure we could find other examples of this. This just happens to be the one that we could find easy. This is Sean Hannity from 10 years ago. I mean, I remember when they were attacking Michelle Obama for just wanting more vegetables during school lunches.
Why not steak?
I don't want the government telling me that I can't put salt on my food. Isn't that our job? Do we have any role or responsibility in life anymore? I like junk food. I like McDonald's. I like Wendy's. I like Burger King. I love Kentucky Fried Chicken. I love Ruth's Chris, my favorite steakhouse. Leave my salt and my McDonald's alone.
There you go.
It is crazy because so much of this is down to lifestyle, and I'm down for, you know, regulating our food supply, but like they have conniptions about 15-minute cities, and like Europe, if you might go to McDonald's, you're probably going to be walking and using public transportation.
Yes, it's a totally different lifestyle.
Your steps in.
It's a totally different lifestyle. And also, because so much is decommodified in many of these countries, you don't need to sit at a desk for 12 hours a day to make sure that you can actually feed your family. You also have more time so that people can cook or take more time to get food. I mean, it's not, you know, it's the dynamic's changing, certainly, in a lot of European countries. But like 10 years ago, 15, 20 years ago, the idea of fast food in Europe was, they were just like, what do you mean? You'd be hard-pressed to find drive-thrus, I think, in Europe. You put in, you know, 500 calories is 500 calories. It's just a question of what's happening over the course of your day to burn calories.
And a lot of Americans are driving all the time. And they drive, and they, like you said, get in the drive-thru. I mean, I went to a lot of McDonald's in you know, London and Paris. Me and my friends, when we were traveling, called it the embassy. Again, yeah, no drive-thrus, and you're walking to it.
It's amazing. All right, number is 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. We'll take a few calls. We got about 30 minutes or so left in the program. This whole Doge thing is absolute garbage. We get these from time to time. We had the Simpson-Bowles commission. Do you remember that? Were you around, Matt, when that was happening?
That was a little bit before my time, but I remember hearing it talked about.
Simpson was a senator from, I want to say, Wyoming. And Alan Simpson, and he famously said while he was a member of this commission, or he was chairing, that we got a problem with old people on the government teat, I think is what he said. And Bowles, Erskine Bowles, was, I want to say, chief of staff for Jimmy Carter. Clinton. And he was also a fan of privatizing Social Security. This is why when people who like Social Security were very, very suspect of Barack Obama. And the rules for this committee were, I think it was something like, there's going to be 8 Democrats and 7 Republicans, the specific numbers, but I think that was the dynamic. And for this committee to make a recommendation, you needed a majority of the committee to sign off on it. And there was so much pushback to this committee amongst Democrats. And it was, I think it was basically made up of sitting senators, if I remember correctly. So it wasn't just sort of randos who hadn't been elected. They could not issue a committee report because they couldn't get a majority of people who would sign on to it. And so they attempted to release these sort of like minority reports. And then the media would pick it up. The Simpson-Bowles Commission says we need to cut the cost of living increases for old people. And I remember going on MSNBC going, Simpson-Bowles Commission did not put out a report based upon their own rules. Some dudes did. But they were just dudes. They weren't the committee, because the committee needed a majority and it didn't get a majority. Well, the rules for the Doge thing is they paid me money to win the election. So whatever. That's the rules. And it's going to be used as a cover. They're going to say that they're cutting the military, and they're going to end up cutting like $5 from the military. But then they're going to go for social services, and even more dramatically, they're going to go for Social Security and Medicare. Here is Representative Greg Lopez, Republican from Colorado, outside the meeting of the Doge Caucus. This is a group of Republicans who are supporting this non-elected bureaucratic committee that is making proclamations on behalf of the richest man in the world.
We're going to just keep asking members of the caucus as they come in, sir, can we get a pledge to stand with President Trump against cuts to Social Security and Medicare benefits?
I think, you know what, when we look to reduce our national debt, I think these should be on the table.
Okay.
You know, so I am a strong advocate of discussing this and reevaluating them. And I do believe at the end of the day, there will be some cuts.
There are cuts to Social Security and Medicare.
Yes.
And that's on the table in the Doge caucus right now.
Well, we're about to find out.
Okay. Thank you so much. So there you have a member of the Doge committee, the Doge caucus.
Pause it for one second. I should tell you that's Alex Lawson from Social Security Works. I suspect that the representative didn't realize.
Right. I was going to say, great for Social Security Works being in that hall.
Oh, yeah. No, Lawson's quite good at this. And, I mean, there you have it. First off, let's be clear. Social Security does not contribute one dime to the deficit. It is statutorily impossible for Social Security to add to the deficit, which is why when the trust fund runs out 2033, although maybe it's 6 months earlier now, if this expansion of who gets Social Security happens. And again, that's an estimate. That's the mid-level estimate. 2033, if Congress does nothing in terms of raising the cap on the payroll tax, there's an automatic cut of about 17%. Why? Because it is illegal for Social Security to add to the deficit. So when that guy says we need to cut Social Security to help with the deficit or the debt, what he's saying is we cut Social Security and then raid the trust fund and raid the Social Security taxes to pay off the cuts to income taxes for wealthy people. That's the formula. You could put that on it. It's that simple. It is that simple. Is there any more? Does he go with anybody else? Or is that it?
They ignore him.
Let's just watch it because I like to watch Alex at work.
Fully supporting cuts to Social Security and Medicare, ignoring the president. Sir, I was hoping we could get a pledge to stand with President Trump against cuts to Social Security and Medicare. Hi. Sir, I was hoping we could get a pledge to stand with President Trump against cuts to Social Security and Medicare. We're going to just keep asking.
Yeah, I mean, that's
very good to start with. Pledge to support.
100%. 100%. He's doing two jobs there simultaneously. He's one, pretending like Trump is threatening them. And two, telling on those who want to cut Social Security. That's why if you're looking for an organization that is protecting Social Security Works is one of the good ones.
SocialSecurityWorks.org.
Alex Lawson does a lot of good stuff that you never, ever hear about. A lot of good stuff. All right, let's go to the phones. Calling from a 308 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from? You were in the pole position.
Hey, it is Kowalski from Nebraska.
I suspected as much. Kowalski from Nebraska. What's on your mind today?
Oh, sorry about that. Was I cutting out?
Nope.
Huh, weird. Anyways, I was calling in because I heard somebody was talking were making some pretty audacious statements about America's food system.
Yes.
Making everyone fat.
How come you're a farmer? Is that not correct?
Well, farmers do play a role as we do produce 100% of the calories you do consume. So,
okay. Why do the calories in this country make you fat, but the calories in Europe do not?
It's called freedom. Europe is a communist continent, so they don't have freedom.
And therefore,
I'm taking notes.
Therefore, their calories, what, they actually take weight off you? Is that how it works there?
Yeah, they it takes from everyone and then it gives it to the government. That's why their governments are so bloated over there.
Oh, because it's all the calories actually add on to the bloat of the governments. I see. Wait,
yes.
I mean,
it has nothing to do with the preservatives that are, you know, in almost all American food, or the increased amounts of salt, which increases your appetite, or the sugar, which creates an addiction and a sweetness that you're instinctively not able to say no to because, you know, in nature, that's rare. And when we were hunter-gatherers, it was an evolutionarily advantageous adaptation to have. That has nothing to do with it.
All right, let me just say on the last part that when I was like an actor, like early days when I was starting out, I was doing comedy, the way that I would decide to eat was, is it free? And if it was free, I would just eat as much as possible at that time. And then when it wasn't, I mean, it's sort of the similar sugar function. You come across it, you eat it because it's there. When you say preservatives, why do we have more preservatives in our food than they do in Europe?
The U.S. food system is more designed for an export market, so we have more redundancy infrastructure in food that can last longer, that can make it overseas. As a result, it influences our domestic markets more. It's one of the reasons why, like, New York, for instance, probably has a lower obesity rate than, like, say, St. Louis, because New York has farms that are closer to the city, and you probably have access to more fresh foods that aren't necessarily designed for the export, but most of the U.S. food production is based around California and the Midwest, which is pretty much all has export infrastructure, so you might as well just make everything ready for export.
Not hearing a lot about personal responsibility, Kowalski.
Well, that is true, I guess. You know, but we are all conscious consumers in this world. So, yeah, it's all personal responsibility.
Let me just drill down one more.
Certainly wasn't a big change in the 80s.
Let me just drill down one more before we get to the change in the 80s and before we get down to the subsidization of corn for a second. When you say, And we see this in other things. Like, for instance, if there are regulations in California about cars, the car makers will end up making all of their cars. They'll change the rate because it's just cheaper than if they were to just, you know, make their cars cleaner for California and not the rest of the country. It's just they standardize because it's just cheaper to do that. When you say that our food supply is designed to export in mind, and not just to provide food for the United States, and therefore the preservatives that allow it to travel around the globe and get consumed there, you know, we get those preservatives in our food, even though we don't necessarily need that level of preservatives. It really is what you're saying is our food is worse because our system's designed to maximize profit for big agricultural firms. Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, basically.
Oh. But that's capitalism.
And the lack of freedom.
That's capitalism. So when we say that European countries, which often are maligned as, you know, being a socialist or socialist-y, they don't have, they're not exporting all their food, and their food system is not based upon profit for these big companies. And so their food is actually healthier. Weird.
I'm sure that doesn't happen in any other industry.
And, you know, it pains me as an Anglophile to say this, but Europe basically has the French to thank for that. From what I understand, the French have worked extremely hard to protect their small farmer base, which has influenced, it's called the Brussels effect. When Brussels comes up with the EU standards, it's pretty much like the entire bloc's standard. Which this is actually one of the things that I wanted to mention to you guys about. I sent you an email about a person I'd like you to interview. I addressed the email from myself. It has the details in it. But essentially, there is like an Americanization of the farm industry in Britain going on right now that the Labour Party is kind of complicit in. And that would be absolutely devastating for them because basically, the EU did a much better job at maintaining smaller family farms, even though the global trend is towards more bigger outfits. It has been a rising concern, and it's something that's been on my radar but I think it deserves more coverage. But yeah, the food systems in Europe are just like, it's more farm to table, so you don't have as many added preservatives. That and like their food sector just isn't quite as consolidated as ours. It could head that way soon, but like it's an issue when only five companies control the food supply.
We will have that guest on in 2025. Just found your email. And
nice.
All right, man.
I did just want to mention a couple things because this will obviously be the last call. As of right now, nobody should be worried about our agricultural production. 2024 was a pretty good year. There's a lot of things up in the air right now with the new farm bill. A lot of issues could come about if the SNAP program gets moved out of HHS because RFK Jr. really wants to be able to tell poor people what they can't eat.
Yep.
And that would be the best way for him to do that. But looking into who the ag secretary will be, and I forget her name right now, she is a power-hungry, crazed lunatic, but I think that'll work in our favor because a power-hungry person isn't going to surrender half of her agency's power. So I think we will see a lot of internal fighting amongst Trump's appointees because it doesn't really seem like they're towards any like overarching goal. It seems like they're more in it for themselves, which I think could cause a lot of disruptions that could be beneficial, at least maintaining the status quo for a while. So,
all right. Kowalski from Nebraska. Thanks, man.
Yep. Have a good one.
Bye.
I'm the guy who thinks that the Republicans are motivated to keep family farms in business. I take that at face value.
Call him from a 908 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hi, this is me.
Yes, this is you.
Hi, I'm Hillary from Brooklyn.
Hillary from Brooklyn. What's on your mind, Hillary?
So I'm a public defender here in New York, and I'm calling about the Manhattan DA's office, wild overreach in charging Luigi Mangione with murder in the first degree. As a little background, people are most commonly charged with murder in the second degree, which is basically just with the intent to cause the death of another person, you cause the death of that person. So it's an intentional killing. Murder in the first degree is an intentional killing plus an aggravating factor. In the case of Luigi, it's basically an intentional killing, and the victim was killed in furtherance of an act of terrorism. An act of terrorism is defined as for the purposes of a violent act. Basically, the murder was for Luigi. The murder was for the purpose of intending to intimidate or coerce a civilian population.
Right. There are three things. As far as I know, in terms of like adding the terrorism to that charge, intimidate or coerce a civilian population, influence policy, a policy unit of government by intimidation or coercion, or affect the conduct of a unit of government by murder, assassination, or kidnapping. This guy obviously didn't work for the government. I don't know what unit of government would be in some way influenced by the killing of a CEO.
No, it has to be the first one.
And intimidate or coerce the civilian population. This guy specifically...
It has to be that.
That is about, like, the random... Isn't that, like, the reason why terrorism coerces or intimidates the civilian population is because almost it's random, right? Like strikes fear in people. And this guy literally like waved a woman away and just said, no, I'm just here for this specific guy.
Well, that's what makes this really interesting and this sort of wild overreach because obviously this aggravating factor was added to the statute after 9/11. That's the kind of terrorism that was envisioned by the legislature when they added this. And so if you think about this indictment, what this means is that they must be defining a civilian population as millionaire CEOs of health insurance companies. And it's interesting because, like, there has been this overreach before, if you'll indulge me. The DA's tried to charge someone related to involved in a gang shooting with this part of the statute. And the DA's, because it was a high publicity case, I think a kid, a random kid was killed in the shooting. So they tried to go for this statute. Oh, and the purpose of this is murder one can carry a sentence of life without parole, as opposed to murder two, which is 25 to life. So in this gang case, it went up to the Court of Appeals, which is our highest court, and the Court of Appeals reversed the conviction and gave this guy a new trial. And there's a good quote. It's called People v. Morales. And they say, sorry, give me a second. They basically, this case basically is saying that the DA's office can't do what they're trying to do with Luigi. You know, they say if we were to apply a broad definition to intent to intimidate or coerce a civilian population, the people could invoke the specter of terrorism every time a blood assaults a Crip or an organized crime family orchestrates the murder of a rival syndicate soldier. But the concept of terrorism has a unique meaning, and its implications risk being trivialized if the terminology is applied loosely in situations that do not match our collective understanding of what constitutes a terrorist act.
So
he's basically doing the same thing. And the only civilian population I can think of are CEOs, because the rest of the population has reacted quite the opposite.
And so what happens if he brings this case and the judge, I mean, is this something that like the judge could theoretically, like the defense will say, we want a summary judgment here, or like what, like walk me through this?
Yeah, so the defense will file a motion that says to like inspect the grand jury minutes, which is basically what was presented to the grand jurors and the legal definitions provided. And, then ask the judge to dismiss any counts that weren't made out in the grand jury. So the judge could do that in an earlier stage of the case. But, you know, if it passes that threshold, then there would be the trial. And at the end of the trial, the defense attorney could again say, okay, after all the evidence was presented at trial, they didn't establish this beyond a reasonable doubt, and have that charge thrown out and not be presented to the jury.
Are there subsidiary charges?
Those two things could happen.
Are there subsidiary charges?
He's charged with murder too as well.
Okay. So,
I have no idea why the DA's office is doing this. I don't understand the strategy. That type of overreach can often shoot them in the foot, and result in an acquittal, you know, so it seems like a publicity stunt, but an unstrategic one, in my opinion.
Yeah, it seems ridiculous to me. I don't know what's behind it, but maybe, you know, CEO funding of his next election. Who knows? I mean, I know maybe you don't want to say that.
I don't know.
I'm happy to say it.
I just think to see how they're going to try to play that.
I appreciate the call.
No, I'm fine with you saying that. Absolutely. All right, thanks.
All right, case dismissed. Wanted to say that to a defense attorney.
That's one thing that from my grand jury experience, I was not the most sort of like ready to throw out charges of all the people on that jury. I mean, I was probably on the spectrum farther, but like very often if it was just like a gun charge that like a guy got, I remember a specific one, guy got caught with a gun in a vehicle, but it was just like a traffic stop, and people who threw it out. I mean, you can just do that. It's a grand jury, so maybe it's a different case with like a trial jury or something like that. But that's why it doesn't surprise me that the Penny case went for 20 hours and they didn't indict, because all it takes is a few people to say, no, I'm not going to do this.
Right. Calling from a 210 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Good afternoon, Sam. This is John from San Antonio.
John from San Antonio. It's been a while, buddy. The last time I saw you was, I think, on stage. In fact, it was the last time I heard from you on stage on a very sort of depressing evening.
Yeah, haven't been feeling well.
Yeah, I haven't been feeling so great either, but I hope you're feeling better.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, so tonight I'm going on the Letter Hacks YouTube show.
Well, I guess you're feeling that much better, but that's okay.
Was it that you weren't feeling well, or you didn't have anything to promote, John?
Well, shots fired.
Yeah, I mean, I am feeling better, but I mean, Letter Hacks has been wanting me to go on his show also, and I haven't been on his show either.
Oh,
so it's at 7:30 Eastern time to talk about the election results. So most people who are interested in politics know that the 2020 election had the highest turnout as a percentage since the election of 1900, before women and most minorities had the right to vote. That nationwide percentage was 66.3% in 2020. This year's total was 63.88%, which makes it tied with the 1960 election for the highest turnouts after the 19th Amendment gave the women the right to vote. In my many calls to the show, I talked about how Biden and then Harris' easiest path to victory was winning the formerly blue wall states of Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, which did turn out to be the three closest states. Turnout as a percentage in all of the most important swing states and most swing states in general was higher than in 2020 by about 1% on average. In the most important swing states, Harris received more votes than Biden in all of the states except for Michigan. Since the 2004 election, there has been a big split between voters under 50 and voters 50 and older, with the most younger voters voting for Democrats more and the older voters voting for Republicans. There are a few exceptions to this, like in Michigan.
John, can I interrupt you for 1 second? You say, sure. I just want to be clear, six out of the seven swing states, Harris got more votes than Biden. Those are raw vote totals, right? Did she get more of the percentage of potential voters?
No, I wouldn't even say six out of seven. I said the most important, you know, because the main things, if she would have won those three states.
Okay, all right, so within those three states, my question still stands. Are we talking about raw vote totals? I mean, because
we're talking raw vote.
Okay,
raw vote total.
What about percentage, though? I mean, because
didn't get the most. I mean, because she would have won the election if she would have got.
No. I mean, relative to Biden, you're saying she outperformed Biden in terms of raw vote totals, but I'm saying that when you look at the cohorts that Biden won, did she? There's a certain amount of inflation associated with this, right? I mean, we have cohorts that Biden won that have gotten bigger. Just as an example, like 18 to 34, there are more people in that cohort as a slice of the pie of potential voters than there was in 2020. And I think part of the story is she underperformed, even though she got more raw votes. She in those states, she underperformed in those percentages.
Yeah, I mean, in certain cases, I mean, yeah, she did. I mean, generally, when you lose an election, you know, you get lower percentages than before. I mean, so in certain
states, I know, but also you can have less, so my point is the raw vote total that she exceeded the raw vote total of Biden is not relevant. She did not exceed it in the amount that she would have had she maintained his percentages.
Yeah. That's true. I mean, she would have won also, going back to the original point.
Yeah.
I mean, so I don't know where we left off. But, I mean, essentially what I'm going to bring up is some demographics where I think the most important demographics. Anyway, I'll just get right to Pennsylvania. In Pennsylvania, the ratio of 50 and older voters compared to under 50 voters was 59-41% in favor of older voters. This year's ratio was 53-47 for older voters also. So younger voters did turn out at high levels, and Harris won every breakdown of under 50 voters by small margins compared to the large margins that Biden won by. The real difference came from voters that are 50 and older. Trump did win those voters by relatively large vote margins, but not as large as in 2020. In 2020 in Pennsylvania, independent voters comprised 19% of the voting population. This year, they comprised 23%. In 2020, Biden won those votes by 8%. This year, Trump won by 7%. In Michigan, they had the third highest turnout rate in the nation at 74.69. This year in Michigan, rural voters made up 22% of the vote, 1% higher than in 2020. But this year, Trump won those votes, those voters by 19% compared to 9% in 2020. It makes around 58,000 more votes for Trump just in rural votes. The Latino vote doubled from 3% in 2020 to 6% this year, and Trump won that vote by 19% after Biden won Latino voters in 2020 by 11%.
That's a huge turnaround.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what I tried to do was look at demographics and see, you know, what the largest, try to see exactly why Trump won. In every demographic, there's going to have an advantage to Trump, but some of them are just really large. And so in Wisconsin, they had the second highest voting percentage in the nation at 76.37%. The urban vote increased from 30 to 35% since 2020, and Harris won that vote by 17 points, but Biden won that vote by 39 points in 2020. There were 9% more rural voters than in 2020, totaling 31% of the vote. And though Trump won those voters by 22% in both years, he increased vote total sufficiently because of the higher turnout rates of rural voters. Harris did better with suburban voters than Biden, tying with Trump among those voters, while Trump won those voters in 2020 by 12 points. In 2020, the ratio of women voters to men was 50-50. This is in Wisconsin. And with Biden winning women by 13%, this year Harris only won them by 8%. Trump won the men's vote by 9% in 2020 and 10% this year. So the lack of women's support hurt Harris. In most states, women do vote at higher rates than men by at least 6%. And so while I agree that Harris should have run a better campaign where she talked about economic challenges voters faced, she did receive a lot of votes and likely hit her win number in many swing states. I thought that the strategy of turning out low-propensity voters that the Trump camp engaged in was incredibly flawed, but in the end, it led him to victory.
Yep.
Many Democratic operatives are concerned. A lot of the base are highly educated voters who already turn out at high percentages, while many with lower levels of education do not vote, and there's a large reservoir of voters to tap into. There, I thought the presidential election would set a record for the three closest consecutive elections in the history of the country, but the 2000, 2004, and 2008 elections still has the record by one electoral vote. In the House, I mentioned several times before the election, this year's House election could be the closest since the 1916 election, in which the Democrats had 218 caucusing members and the Republicans had 217. This year it wasn't that close, but it was the closest since the 19th Amendment was put in place in 1920. The final tally was 220 Republican seats and 215 Democratic seats. After World War II, the average number of seats that flip away from the party that is in power is 25 seats. If the Democrats would have had 7,510 more votes in Iowa's 1st District, Colorado's 8th District, and Pennsylvania's 7th District, they'd have won the House. The last midterm that Trump was in office, the generic ballot flipped by 9.7% to the Democrats. If that happens again, the number would be 6.7 advantage for the Democrats. This is in 2026, and they'll have 237 seats after the election. In the Senate, Republicans hold a 53-47 advantage, so the Democrats will have to flip four seats to retake the Senate in 2026. Susan Collins will be the easiest target. Tom Tillis is another potential win for the Democrats in North Carolina. The other two seats will be the next to impossible to flip, though Trump's probable unpopularity because he seems to be more determined to be more extreme in the upcoming term than the first. If Sherrod Brown were to run again, and there are some signs that he is going to do that, in Ohio, he'll probably be the best shot to beat a Republican. The other four possibilities are long shots. Dan Osborne just lost by 6.8% in Nebraska. John Tester lost by a slightly higher amount. They're possible Democratic candidates. Joni Ernst and John Cornyn are Republicans running, but I don't expect many challenges from other sitting members of the House when the odds are so long. Connecticut Democratic Senator Chris Murphy says there are only 52 potential Democratic Senate seats, while there are 62 potential Senate seats for the Republicans. There are seven seats that could go either way. Those states are Maine, Wisconsin, Arizona, Michigan, Nevada, Georgia, and North Carolina. On the bubble is New Hampshire, which ended up being the fifth closest state in the presidential race, with a lower margin than three of the seven swing states who were frequently discussed. So that's 19 solid Democratic states, including New Hampshire, and 24 that are Republican. So what do you think of that analysis of the Senate races? And if you have any questions or comments, I'll be happy to address them.
I think that, that analysis, at least in looking towards the future, comports with what I'm thinking. I would also add that there were three, if I'm not mistaken, House seats that were gerrymandered out in North Carolina from the Democrats, and that would have made the difference, too, in this election, aside from the 7,500 votes that you were talking about over the course of three districts. I think... I think that the Democrats have a real uphill battle in 26 of the Senate. I think less so for the House, but we'll see. I also, it's so hard to predict what Trump's going to do over the next 2 years and what the Republicans are going to do. So it's hard to assess. But all right, John. Well, we're up against it, but that's a good breakdown. A little depressing. Maybe you can crunch some numbers and make it a little more hopeful, in the coming weeks. But let me just take this time since, almost our last show, last couple of shows of 2024 to thank you for all of your analysis. I'm sorry that Emma's not here to, officially say you were right. She was wrong. But I will say that on her behalf. I was a little more skeptical, but the exuberance of youth, you want, sometimes you get a little aspirational. You understand that, right?
Yeah. Like I told her, backstage on election night that, I hope that what she says is right, and I was trying to talk about that they really do have a really good chance of retaking the House. The Democrats in 2026. I know that seems like a long way away, but it's actually only like with 14 and a half months of the early, Super Tuesday states. And
it's not even my. It's not even 5% of my life. 2 years.
I'm hoping for a big progressive. Resurgence is what I'm hoping for. More Justice Democrat type candidates, and be covering those races live like I did this year.
All right. Well, we'll talk to you in 2025. But thank you for all your help this year, John. I appreciate it.
All right. Well, thank you for giving me an opportunity. Appreciate it.
Bye bye. Have fun on the whatever that show is. Letter Hack.
Yeah, 7:30 Eastern.
7:30 Eastern. All right. Thanks, John.
Yeah.
Al Conniption, Sam, you said Allred was going to win. How is that being more skeptical than Emma? I mean, that was definitely aspirational.
Yeah.
That was definitely aspirational. I actually thought like in the Senate that we had better shot. Folks, that is the end of our phone call portion of our program. I know. I've disappointed everybody. You guys aren't the first. And you won't be the last. Couple of IMs, and then we're out of here. Jody from Chicago is looking up the congresspeople who didn't vote for the Iron Dome and doesn't take AIPAC money. By the way, my congressperson, Chuy Garcia, is one of those, but so is Republicans Thomas Massey. What do you think his deal is? Massey's like a, you know, full-on sort of like isolationist. And, you know, there's, let me just put it this way. Pat Buchanan used to have me on back in the day on MSNBC in like the mid-aughts because I was the only Jew that he could get on to criticize Israel. So Pat Buchanan could look past the fact that I was a Jew. But I also remember like at the DNC in 2004, having a conversation on Radio Row with a conservative talk show host who didn't realize that I was not a conservative talk show host, or maybe he did, but he didn't realize that I was Jewish. And he was trying to say like, you know, I'm not like, Bush and these, you know, neocons. I'm a Buchananite. I'm not like one of these Jews. I was like, oh, okay. Well, that's good to know. So there's no chance of us running into each other at Shul. He was a little taken aback.
Where was he from?
I don't, it was some like, you know, regional talk radio show host who apparently felt it comfortable in Boston, Mass at the DNC to be thrown around. I'm not one of those Jews. All right.
Future of the Republican Party.
Yep. Sam from Ottawa, sounds strategic if you're in the district attorney's department and not too happy with your health care. Overreach on purpose to elicit a not guilty verdict, perhaps. That would be, that seems unlikely.
Well, but there's a lot of charges that don't have the aggravated terrorism thing. So those are just the top ones.
Freedom Town, cops when someone shoots up a school and has a manifesto filled with racism. We can't find a motive. JR in Philly, Sam, RFK Jr. has skeletons in his closet, but since Trump picked him and Trump is anointed by God, the real one, the Christian one, RFK is forgiven. I don't know why this is so hard for you to comprehend. No, I get it. Gold Rush John, Phil also has to listen to Tim's falsetto vocals and tell him things like, that sounds pretty tight, bro. Oh, is he his resident, like, your music's cool, man.
I think he must be in the band, I would think, but maybe I'm wrong.
Progressive Bandio, screw Biden for not getting the joy out of the position of Postmaster General. He could have aggressively got those directors appointed to the board and gotten them off swiftly, but he did not. He agreed. Jerry at the beach, I'm a letter carrier in New Jersey, and our union needs to fight. My shop steward is going to teach me the ins and outs, and I'm going to get involved and try and work my way up. We really need new leadership. It'd be nice if we had a Democratic Party with some teeth on our side. Yeah. Chicago letter carrier. Did you know the Postal Inspection Service is the oldest law enforcement agency in the country? I did not know that. Kirby, I'm a union steward who was inspired to get involved in my union because of this show. Had my second disciplinary meeting as a representative and we nailed it. Left is best. Oh, I'm
awesome.
Very glad to hear about that. That's nice. Dan from Columbus, telling someone not to say or overuse like are the most surefire ways to get them stuttering. Buckets and Buckets. Sam, will you be going on any shows over the break? Not to my knowledge. When Israel bombs Iran, I'll probably hop on the YouTube stream. I think I'm going to do that Jubilee thing.
Oh, yeah.
In late January.
It'll be fun.
I'm not sure.
Is that down in Florida?
No, I think it's in California.
Oh, well.
So I got to figure that out. All right, two more. Ramona Frankenstein, can I get a shofar for my Aunt Anne, who passed away very suddenly on Saturday at 55? She was a beloved nurse who worked in a few Boston area hospitals, including Boston Children's Hospital, when they were getting bomb threats for providing gender-affirming care. I will love her and miss her for the rest of my life, and I'll always be thankful for her loud and proud support of me when I came out as trans. I love you, Anne. This goes to her. Dizzle McFizzle. Those old F's are going to kill us all, and the worst part is they won't be alive to reap the bitter fruit they planted. Nancy, you ignorant dummy. All right, two more. Most pens are blue. Democrats are blue. Checkmate, libs. The final I am of the day. Sam, have you seen Hochul's proposed CEO threat hotline? I heard about that vaguely. She wants to make sure that the state resources, specifically the domestic counterterrorism resources, are focused on being supportive, sharing information. Just insane, says Dave from upstate.
I tweeted out the day of that Republicans are focused on channeling all this energy towards trans people and refugees, and Democrats are going to be calling CEOs to make sure they feel safe. And that's literally what they did.
Folks,
make them a protected class.
Exactly. Can't we put them into like Title IX protections or something?
Protect them against majority rule.
Emma will be back tomorrow. Bradley, Matt, great job today. Folks, we'll see you then.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. Finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light's shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that finally breaks you. I get somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I